The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Empowerment Hour, positive insights into many of our problems and how easy the solutions are. If the solutions are that easy, why aren't we engaging in them? Well, because we confuse the simplicity of a solution with the complexity, contortion, and convolution of how we hold on to our dysfunction. And therefore, the problem isn't that we don't have solutions. We do to everything. It's just that you got to change your mind in order to change a problem. So we can't change minds easily. So then we look at all the different ways that we can see a problem. Today we're going to take a look with our guest, Derek Jensen. Quite simply, he is one of the nation's leading voices of cultural and environmental dissent. And we're going to talk about our civilization's pathologies, the role of materialistic life in the destruction of nature and an awakened culture. What's the next step? And I also want to mention that I'm rearranging the segments of the programs. Henceforth, we will have our opening on health and nutrition and healing, then our environmental update, then our guest, then our issues of the day and open calls. And because we're broadcast all over the world, and a lot of stations carry us for 54 minutes, 55 minutes, 56 minutes, 60 minutes, and sometimes I'm still talking with a guest when the program runs out of time. I appreciate that can be frustrating to people. So this way, we won't have that problem. And also, we have selected the guest who will be on for 1 hour, just the guest. That will only be on our Monday evening show, because that's our Progressive Commentary Hour, and we already have several lined up. We're going to be doing a one-hour program, uninterrupted, and may go longer on the failed war on drugs and what we should do if we want to keep young people out of prison and deal with the drug problem. We're going to have a one-hour program on the International Monetary Fund, an hour program on globalization, an hour program on the World Bank and structural adjustment around the world, an hour program on the Federal Reserve, and it's what it's doing today. So these will be 1 hour full programs with one or more guests or panels, and that will be on Monday evenings, 7 to 8 p.m. Progressive Radio Network. But 98% of all people do not listen live. They download the shows. So if you should have listened to a program, didn't get the full message, go to the archives, and the full message is always there. So you won't really have missed anything if you want that information. Today, America's 14 most ready to riot cities. Op-ed News, Chaz Valenza. Running through riotous London, a thought. And then, Anarchy and Austerity, Why London Won't Be the Last City to Burn, from the Atlantic. And from our environmental perspective today, the Shell Oil's Arctic Drilling Plan, it's just another disaster waiting to happen. This is from Rolling Stone, Tim Dickinson. So we have a lot to share with you. Let's begin. Some reasons you should be eating your beets, but more importantly, I believe, drink your beet juice. Now, I want to share a recipe. This past weekend, I was in Denver, premiered two new television programs, and then flew immediately into L.A. and did a lot of lecturing, but also a lot of sharing of insights on our nuclear legacy at the theater there. In between, I ran off to a little nice food restaurant, and someone gave me a juice. It was kind of a red looking juice, and I said, "What's that juice?" And they said, "Well, that's our beet juice." Okay, I'll try it. Didn't taste like beets. I said, "This has an unusual taste, and it's thin, it's not thick." what'd you do? Well, we soak our beets, then we juice them, and we keep out any of the pulp, and then we add lemon and lime to that with a pinch of cherry concentrate, organic cherry concentrate, and then we chill it. Whoa, talk about good and thirst quenching. So I asked the person, I said, do you know why you should be making this juice and drinking it? Well, because people like it. I said, well, let me share a few thoughts with you. Number one, beet juice, or just understand I'm always referring to organic, is very alkaline, and hence it can help stop what is known as local acidosis. And acidosis is where a lot of diseases occur. For example, arthritis, acidosis. Bursitis, fibromyalgia, pains in the muscle, acidosis. Achy joints, acidosis. Macular degeneration, acidosis. So cancer, almost always acidosis. So you want to convert your acid to an alkaline. Beet juice is one of the best things you can do. By the way, there is one other thing you could do. You could make a beet juice. I do this as a salad dressing. It's one of my recipes. I make the beet juice with lemon, but then I add watermelon. And when you combine watermelon, beet, and lemon, and you chill it down, I even make it into ice cubes. And then I throw all those ice cubes into a blender and blend it up. Boy, that'll quench your thirst. But you can also drizzle it around a plate and make it very decorative. And you can take tofu, and you can sear the tofu on both sides, then baste the top and bottom of the tofu with the very same juice. You just take a simple little basting brush after your tofu has been grilled, but not before, and then baste it in this. Now, if you want some really exotic variety, when you're making your beet juice, simple, takes you 1 minute, throw in some raspberries and some orange with the peel. And that gives you a very exotic flavor. And then baste your tofu and with that. And then you can keep that as part of your ongoing condiments in the refrigerator. You don't need salt then, because it satisfies the taste for salt. It also has a bittersweet quality. It's neither sweet nor bitter, and it's alkalizing, so you can decorate a dish with it. You can use it as a salad dressing, and then if you really want to make a nice dressing for your brown rice, same identical recipe, except blend in some almonds till they're smooth, and then you put that on brown rice. So you have a gravy, but it's not your typical boring oat gravy. I mean, you go into these natural food restaurants, it's like they have two chefs, one to cook the food, one to take the taste out. So you might as well eat cardboard. So this way, it makes it more exotic. Now, just use that as a base, but you can change it. You can do a lot of different things. I do the same thing with tomatoes. I will first soak a tomato. Now, what happens when you soak a tomato? This one, my own little experiment that I did long ago, and it worked. Soak a tomato in water, and what that does, it increases the sugar content in the water. Then when you blend the tomato, you suddenly get a very sweet tomato. And it comes with a full richness, because what you're doing is the enzymes in the tomato are maturing. And it's the enzymes maturing that causes the taste of any fruit or vegetable. Hence, when you eat vine-ripened fruit, you're getting the best fruit. When you pick a fruit that may look okay but isn't heavy in water, it won't have that taste. And since shippers like to ship everything at once, they'll pick all the cherries, but the cherries are not fully ripe. And as you taste a cherry, it looks nice, but it doesn't have any taste. A peach doesn't have any taste. A plum doesn't have any taste. The way you should always know that something is ripe is a cherry, a plum, a peach, a nectarine. Put your hand, your palm of your hand, on the fruit and lift it up, oh, maybe 2 inches, and then pull your hand away. If it drops, it's ready to eat. If it doesn't, it still has a little time. So that way you're getting a tomato that's ripe. Then you're helping even that, in a natural way, speed up the ends are fully finished, the enzymatic evolvement. And then cut the tomato in half. Always use the bottom half of tomato for juices and sauces. Why? The vast majority of the sweetness is in the bottom of the tomato, not the top. Use the top part, make it into a sauce, or dice it into a salad. You don't throw it away, but you're not going to get the same flavor. And then once you have that tomato, the real juice, put it in the fridge. But always mix vitamin C and lemon juice by putting a small amount of lemon juice and about 200 milligrams of vitamin C. You can cause any juice to last about 4 days longer. Ideally, a fresh squeezed juice that has some vitamin C added will last about 2 weeks refrigerated. So then, now let's say you've got a beet juice and you've got a tomato juice. You can then do the same thing with celery juice. You juice your celery, you add some vitamin C and lemon juice, and then now you've got bases. So then, let's say that you want to do something a little exotic in a stir fry. All right, then let's add in some. We start off, let's say, with our celery juice, and we squirt that celery juice in a little squirter, a little dispenser. But then you can throw in some herbs. If you want to have basil or cayenne, whatever you wanted. But the liquid of the juice and the subtle flavor of the juice is enhancing because it's enveloping the entire product. It's just a way to make your cooking more interesting, more creative, tastier, and healthier. Now, a couple other reasons I would give. We know now that beet juice is important in helping liver cells to cleanse. It protects your bile ducts, and it also helps the kidneys. It's one of the best things in the world for helping the kidneys. Celery juice and beet juice. If you took a glass of celery juice in the morning and a glass of beet juice with the same recipe I just gave you in the afternoon, you would help protect your kidneys. Your kidneys would stay healthier longer. And also, beets and celery help cleanse the blood. And with beets, you're creating more red blood cells. And if you added pomegranate seeds that you can buy into your beet juice with lemon, you're super potentizing your red blood cells. That means you're less likely to have anemia. You're going to have more energy. Your blood will be thicker and stronger. Not thicker as far as clumping, but richer and stronger. And also, it's great if you know someone who has leukemia or cancers. Also, beets are a great source of folate. And folate is the natural base of folic acid. It helps your blood cells. It's very important for pregnant women. And in fact, it's extremely healthy. If you take it in its natural form, which is folate from beets, it is better than folic acid from a vitamin supplement. And unfortunately, people think that both terms are interchangeable. They're actually not. Also, beets contain a lot of lutein, L-U-T-E-I-N, and zeaxanthin, both of which can help prevent macular degeneration, cataracts, and glaucoma. There's also a phytonutrient, a series called betalains, B-E-T-A-L-A-I-N-S, and those are extremely anti-inflammatory, I should say. They help turn off inflammation throughout the body. That means your heart, your kidneys, your lungs, your brain are all protected. It will lower blood pressure. It improves the blood vessel elasticity. And it helps you eliminate varicosities. That means varicose veins. And so for detoxing, for getting heavy metals out, for helping with headaches and fatigue, you've got it. You've got the juice. One other thing concerning what we can take in each day is aronia. A-R-O-N-I-A. It is a berry. It's a superfood. Lots of studies on it. It's a aronia fruit, and it's very dense in protective healing properties. It can lower blood pressure. It can help you with cardiovascular disease, cancer, and diabetes. It's extremely rich in anti-aging nutrients. You might have heard it called a choke berry, and it's from North America, and it grows on a very robust shrub, and generally in the swamps or damp woodlands. You'll see it up in where the tree lines in the higher mountain range, and the moisture changes, and that's where you see a lot of these. It will reduce tumors, it can stabilize your blood sugar, and improves cardiovascular health. It's great as an anti-inflammatory, but also for those of you who have age-defining illnesses, hepatitis or herpes, cytomegalovirus or Epstein-Barr virus, it's known to have very, very strong antiviral properties, more so than any other berry I know. So having aronia three times a day if you have viral activity would be very protective. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on nutrition. Back in a moment with our environmental report and our guest, Derek Jensen. Please stay with us. To welcome all of you to this program. I'm Gary Knoll. We're here to empower people, to give you positive information that you can use to make your life happier and healthier. From our environmental section, before we go to our guest, and remember, our guest now will come on in the second segment of our program. We actually have six segments of the program, but we do health and nutrition and healing, then environmental issues, then our guest, then issues of the day, and your phone calls. This is from Tim Dickinson from Rolling Stone. It says, Shell's Arctic drilling plan. It's short, but I think it's very important. I'll quote this. The Interior Department has green-lighted Dutch Royal Shell's exploration plans for offshore drilling in the Arctic Ocean after finding no evidence that a potential spill larger than Exxon Valdez will significantly affect the quality of human environment. The decision is premised on the oil company's fantastical claims that it will be capable of recovering 90% of any oil that hits the water after a Gulf-style blowout. Shell is now on track to begin Arctic drilling by next July. Now, why is this important? Because we have forgotten about the consequences of the first major problem, and that is the Gulf of Mexico oil spill last year. It's out of the news. And there's a saying in the media, if it bleeds, it leads, which means if there's violence, riots, major catastrophe, earthquake, tornadoes, damage, people hurt, airplane down, that's what leads in the media. Depending upon the significance of the story, it will lead anywhere for a few days to maybe 2 or 3 weeks. Then we get tired of it, and then we go on to something else, and we forget about it. I would like to hear from anyone in this audience who has been adversely affected because of the health consequences of the toxic water and toxic air in the Gulf area. If you live in Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, and Florida, I'd like to hear from you because I'll be down there filming next week. We're going to film this week or later on up in Boston on some an important new documentary I'm doing, but I'm going to show that the real full story of the damage from the Gulf spill wasn't just in how long it took to clean up or cap it, but we didn't do a darn thing to help all those people who are now poor, lost their homes, lost their jobs, can't work, and yet when they tried to get someone to pay attention that their health was damaged because of the Gulf spill, nobody wanted to acknowledge that. So once again, we're not acknowledging and helping people who've been adversely affected. Also, this Saturday and Sunday, I'll be filming people who have benefited from ozone therapy. If you have benefited, please call our producer on this segment. We're going to put this up on the internet. It's just part of what we're doing to show. I'm doing one on Ayurvedic medicine, on homeopathy, on mixed chiropractic, on trigger point therapy. I'm going to do short films, one-hour films, with clinicians, scientific evidence, and patients who have benefited from different therapies, and simply talking about it. I want to show you, and I'll have these up on YouTube. So if you've benefited from ozone therapy, please call Paola at 646-926-5439. 646-926-5439. Let's go over and say hello to my guest who's standing by. He is Derek Jensen. And Derek writes on how civilization is devastating the environment and the natural world and our society's denial of that fact. In 2008, Utney Reader listed Derek as one of the 50 visionaries changing the world. And he has a lot of books and articles that he's written out there. His most recent is Dreams. And it's a thorough critique against the fundamentalist Christian legalist morality and materialistic view that Western civilization is right, and it's right when it commits violence against nature. Nice to have you with us today, Derek.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Derek, sustainability, according to the UN definition, is taking only what you need to survive from the available resources while not depriving future generations from relying on those same resources. So, deconstruct, please, for us the fundamental basis of essential consciousness, or lack thereof, that supports and feeds and fuels Western civilization that is contrary to this definition of sustainability.
Well, I would say that even in this definition, we have a little bit of a problem already when they talk about... Can you read the definition again, please?
Yes. The definition of sustainability is... This is according to the UN.
Uh-huh.
And I just pulled this morning. Taking only what you need to survive from the available resources while not depriving future generations from relying on those same resources.
Well, I think part of the problem is in perceiving the world as consistent in the first place. So many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners still perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor. And another way to say that is that for most of us in the Western world, we perceive the world as consisting of resources, and a resource is something that you can use and use up, as opposed to perceiving the world as consisting of other beings to enter into relationship with. And there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them like dollar bills. You're going to use them and use them up. And if you look at trees and you see trees, you'll treat them differently. And if when I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I see it differently still. That's an example of this in the local newspaper last crab season, which was... The harbor master was saying why the crabbers work so hard for the, I think it's 10 days or 2 weeks of the crab season. And they said, imagine all these, there's all these envelopes on the ground, and every envelope has $1.50 in it. That's how much they can sell each crab for. Every envelope has $1.50 in it. You're going to run around picking up as many envelopes as you can. Well, the problem with this, many problems, one of them is that they actually aren't envelopes filled with $1.50. What they are is other beings whose lives are just as precious to them as yours is to you and mine is to me. And the same is true for, you know, trees. The same is true for the soil. The soil is a living being. And this is not, you know, cosmic woo-woo thinking. This is simply true. What is it? Every gram of soil has, I don't know, I'm making up the numbers, you know, 100,000 different beings in it. And maybe a million, I don't know, a lot.
More bacteria than there are people on Earth, which would be more than 7 billion bacteria.
And so part of the point, yes, exactly, and part of the point is that we are, when the world is, I don't even use the term ecosystem anymore because it's machine language. It's natural communities. There are these communities that are incredibly complex so now back to, that was a long sort of parenthetical comment about the word resources, but then there's another problem too, which is that, which has to do with this whole notion of resources, which is that so many people in this culture, it's an incredibly narcissistic culture where we don't perceive anyone else as having needs of their own. And something that I really hate about seeing articles in the newspaper about species extinction, for example, is that if some article talks about how salmon populations are collapsing, they always have to bring it back to how much that's going to cost somebody financially. And it ends up that the only reason that they particularly care about they, being a lot of people in this culture, and sort of the general discourse, the only reason they would care that salmon would go extinct is because it would cost fishermen money. Or the only reason they would care about, this or that being. And I have to mention that one of the most important books I ever read in my life was The Natural Alien by Neil Everdon. I read it I was in a library in my late 20s, and it jumped off the bookshelf at me, and it was the first book I ever read that didn't take the utilitarian worldview, this notion that everybody is here for us, as a given. I remember this one exchange that he described in the book, where he says, what do you do if you're describing, why some creature needs to be protected, and then at the end, when you get done giving this impassioned plea, the person says, well, that's all fine, but what good is it? And Neil Everdon said, well, really the only way you can respond to this is by saying, well, what good are you? And not to insult the other person, but to show the stupidity and the craziness of a whole utilitarian worldview. I'm sure we've all seen those analyses where if they figure out, that you would be worth $7.50 if they, if they took your bones for $2 to make fertilizer in your blood for $4, and we're actually not worth that much if we just look at us in terms of meat and bones and blood, but our value is much greater. One more thing, and then I'll shut up about this. But I was doing a talk by video with some people at Yale, and this one guy was talking about, don't I think it's great that there are some economists who are starting to put economic values on forests besides their value as timber. I said, no, I don't think that's actually so good. I mean, sure, in a practical sense, it's better that it be valued for its ability to stop floods and everything, but I really don't like it otherwise, because I think it's merely bringing everything into this horrible system where everything is valued only by where money is more important than life. And I said, for example, how much are you worth? I did that exact thing right there. And he said, well, actually, the UN has put a value on my life, and the value on my life, since I live in the United States, since I'm going to Yale, since I'm fairly high income potential, that my value would be about $4 million or something like that. I said, well, okay, great. So let's, why don't we make a deal right now where the government will give your family $5 million and they'll kill you. So how's that sound? Sound like a good deal? Actually, it's a great economic deal because you're only worth $4 million. They're going to give you $5 million. And he didn't really like the idea. And my point in bringing all that up is that I don't think we can ever have a way of living that will be sustainable so long as we perceive the world as consisting of resources as opposed to as consisting of other beings with whom we should have a relationship, which doesn't mean that we can't eat them. I'm not talking about vegetarianism, non-vegetarianism. I'm not saying you can never use a tree, but you have to you have to recognize that this other, that this tree has its own life too, and it has a role to play in the community.
Okay. I'm going to share a thought, then I'm going to ask you a philosophical, metaphysical question, all right?
Mm-hmm.
I had a chance to see An Inconvenient Truth in a theater, I was on tour at the time, and I decided to go look at it. And it was a upscale, more liberal environment, and I watched the film, and there were certainly a lot of things I appreciated about the film, and I so stated what I thought could have been expanded on significantly were showing all the alternatives. In other words, you show the problem, now give us some good, strong reason to believe in hope beyond the problem. And I didn't feel that was there. Also, I thought it would have been very good of Al Gore had he at least explained his own complicity with Bill Clinton in being one of the most non-environmental friendly presidencies in American history. And I had over 227 areas I had studied and was doing a report on about how the faux Democrats, or faux liberals, I should say, had really been at the front of destroying the environment on behalf of corporate sponsors. Anyhow, that never happened. But afterwards, there were a lot of people talking out in the lobby of the theater, and I was just kind of hanging back and getting some ideas, since these were open discussions, and I was just listening. And they were talking about how important this information was. And then, this is the kicker, we went outside, right? Everybody was going to go home. I'm going to guess there's about 400 people. I just see nothing but Bentleys, BMWs, SUVs, nothing but that. But then right beside the theater was a big Starbucks, so that place became immediately full. So I went inside, and I'm looking, and it's all junk food, and of course, and it's coffee. And then the question is, because I had just done a report on this a week before, about how much of the people paid who harvest those coffee beans? What are the environmental conditions under which they are grown? How much of nature is abused in the process of getting us the coffee bean? And then I was driving back to my hotel, and I went through this very nice neighborhood, a kind of a beautiful homes, and I saw all these cars that left at the same time pulling in these homes. So here we have people who are very, very motivated by a film that shows that they and everything in their lifestyle, from the private jets and the big homes they don't need, and the eating the junk food, but gourmet junk food, of course, and driving their gigantic car guzzlers, that seems to be disconnected. That part of their reality is disconnected from this so-called ideal thought. If I think in something, read something, view something that's more idealistic, I don't have to change anything in my own life. Your thoughts on that kind of living hypocrisy that both the left and the right breed every day?
Well, I think the one thing that can't be questioned, I think one of the things that can't be questioned in this culture is capitalism itself and civilization itself and industrialism. And one of the problems I had with that film, and I actually just saw Food, Inc. a few days ago, which I'd never seen before, and I had the same problem with it, that many of these films do great jobs of laying out these horrendous problems, and then when it comes to solutions, they fall apart completely because they refuse to question capitalism. And
my thoughts on that real quick, and then I'll not interrupt you. Everyone says, you got to see Food, Inc., Food, Inc. Okay. So the opening scene, the writer, director, producer of the film is in a fast food joint eating a big hamburger that he says he loves and is his favorite food. And I'm thinking, all right, maybe there'll be some epiphany in the film where he'll say, but I learned the suffering of the animals. He had no problem with you causing suffering to the animals, providing it was organic suffering. As long as you were able to feed an animal, then kill it organically. And he actually showed it in one scene. If you remember, the guy's just sitting there talking. He's cutting the chickens apart and disentrailing them. And I'm thinking, whoa, you know, what part of this? So once again, what you have is you have people who have some parts of a puzzle, but not all of it. and they're not looking for the other parts. They think whatever they have is the whole picture. So what is shared about commercial farming? Good. That part I could support. It's how limited we go in making our message all-inclusive. We just don't seem to have that in our
society.
Well,
one of the things that happens if you don't question the larger picture, such as Al Gore not questioning capitalism, is that it ends up that the solutions you present are going to be
capitalist driven.
Are going to be capitalist, and they're going to be superficial, and they will be absurd. They won't be up to the scale of the problem. There's one of my favorite books ever was this book called The Nazi Doctors by Robert J. Lifton. And in this book, he asked how it was that men who had taken the Hippocratic Oath could work in Nazi death camps. And what he found was that actually many of the doctors cared very deeply for the health of the inmates, and they would do everything they could to help the inmates. For example, they would, if they were in pain, they would give them an aspirin to lick, or if they were, they would give them an extra scrap of potato, or they would hide them from the selection officers who were going to kill them. They would do all this stuff that was very important, except they wouldn't do the most important thing of all, which is they wouldn't question the existence of the death camp itself. And this is what I see so many people doing, which is, let's fiddle, and it's the same with Food Inc. as it is with An Inconvenient Truth, as it is with all of these, that many of these people, may or may not be of good heart, and they may really want to present some solutions, but as long as they don't question the fundamental, as long as they don't go to the foundations of the problem, the solutions are going to be, and I see this with environmentalists all the time, so many of us want to work as hard as we can to protect this or that piece of ground, but we aren't actually questioning, why is this ground being destroyed in the first place? And if you don't question agriculture, you can't solve the problems that are caused by agriculture. And if you don't question industrialization, you can't solve the problems that are caused by industrialization. And so part of it is, and I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't do activism on specific issues, and I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't do films, as you're doing with all these YouTube videos that show problems and work on particular issues. I think that that's incredibly important stuff. At the same time, I think that it's also really important to recognize that the problems are deeper, and that wind energy is not going to solve the problems caused by a larger industrial system any more than increased regulation of slaughterhouses or increased regulation of Monsanto will solve the huge problems caused by mass agriculture in the first place.
I would agree with that. Derek, my last question for you. And again, as I mentioned, this is more philosophical and metaphysical, and it's rarely ever raised in progressive alternative media, particularly by liberals, and that's the concept of evil. Usually we only hear this term used in referring to brutal dictatorships such as the Nazis or Pol Pot or Mao's Cultural Revolution, where there was indiscriminate violence for the sake of violence. But rarely do we ever speak about the evil of Wall Street or Christian radicalism, the government, the Tea Party support of the corporate rape of people's livelihoods, or the philosophy of Ayn Rand. Yes, we are happy to speak of evil of Islamo-terrorism, but we never step back and look at the evil, and I don't exclude demonic evil either, that is inflicted daily by energy companies, companies like Monsanto and Walmart and Wall Street speculators and politicians. So I'd like to hear your thoughts about this and how you see, if you do, I'm not assuming you do, but if you do, the kind of evil is possibly an inherent attribute of Western civilization's current gospel of how it defines itself.
Wow, what a great question. And I wish we had hours and hours to spend on this, because I think this is a hugely important question. I think that there is a... you know, I've written, what, 18, 20 books now trying to describe why this culture is so destructive. And for me, simple things like, oh, people are just greedy, doesn't really work. And one of the reasons that that's not sufficient is because this culture is killing the planet, and it doesn't do... It's no use retiring rich on a planet being murdered. And also, another thing that helps me understand this is the level of violence against women in this culture. The gold standard studies are that one out of every four women is raped in her lifetime. Another one-fifth have to fend off rape attempts. And so if we just do the numbers on that, there's about 7 billion humans on the planet, so about 3.5 billion are women. So that means that about 800 million women will be raped in their lifetime. And let's say half of them have not yet been raped. They're too young. So it's that means 400 million women living right now have been sexually assaulted. And that's larger than the Capital H Holocaust. It's larger even than the number of people killed in the slave trade. And we don't talk about that. And my point in bringing all that up is that, yes, I understand the feminist analysis of how rape is an act of political terror in order to create a group of subservient women to change the behavior of half the human population. I understand that. But that doesn't alter the fact that, and also most of the rapes are being done not by, you know, burly strangers who break in through the window, but instead it's being done by dad, by uncle, by babysitter, by people who know them. And my point is, there's not, I understand once again the feminist analysis of how that's an act of political terror, but at the same time, it's not sufficient to explain it to me. If people are going to that drastically harm those they love or purport to love, that's really, really messed up. And so part, you know, honestly, one of the only ways that I can understand the rapaciousness, the insatiability of the dominant culture, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. And I'm sure you've noticed that the attitude of governments toward the melting ice caps is not horror or shame or let's do something about this.
Resource exploration.
It's lust. It's this eagerness that lust is the only word I can come up with for the additional minerals that they're going to be able to get access to and the additional oil. And that sort of insanity, that sort of you know, it would be a whole huge topic for us to talk about what is the source of that evil.
Then Derek,
yes, I do believe that it's that is evil.
Well, I do too. I just believe it is more endemic than what we appreciate, and it's specifically able to be manifested in those who are so insecure and so disconnected from the spiritual. You cannot have half of a truth as the basis of your life. It's like homeopathy. If you recognize that homeopathy works, then you have to recognize its opposite is also working, which means that if a very subtle energy of a product is able to rebalance the energies of a body, the humoral immune system, for example, so something that would cause a burn and manifestation of Simpson burn, like putting your hand over a fire, then if you use poison ivy homeopathically, something would cause, if you put poison ivy on your skin, you're going to blister and redden. So by using homeopathy from poison ivy on a burn, it helps heal the burn. It's based upon the laws of similars. The same has to be true for everything in life. You cannot have an isolated universal truth. It's just, are you wise enough to apply it to everyday living? So you cannot have a body that is born of a spiritual purity, an inner universal connectedness to all things that are perfect, without also acknowledging a universal evil that is also it is also interconnected, is which do we end up manifesting, honoring, and living through. And so this whole idea that I love you but I'm going to have to hurt you is non-existent. Either you're loving someone or you're hurting them. You can't hurt someone you love. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely.
So
yeah,
we have people say, I'm going to serve you, and then serve themselves. We have people say, I care about the wilderness, and then exploit it. Well, which is it? Do you care about the wilderness, in which case you're going to not exploit it? So we end up living with a dual reality. Dualism is virtually the new norm. You can tell me one thing and do the opposite, and I'll believe what you tell me, and I'll deny or apologize for what you've actually done. The Democrats are masters of doing it. Look at Bill Clinton. Look at Barack Obama. The Republicans are masters of doing it. Look at George Bush and George Bush. It doesn't matter. And Reagan, these are all sociopathic personalities. These are people who manifest the energies that they have perfected. And then how do you hide the ugly nature, the dark side of your being? In other words, if you're a liar, but you don't want the world to believe you're a liar, how do you convince the world you're not a liar? If you're a psychopath, a narcissist, who only cares about yourself and are disconnected from the consequences to other people, from your actions, how do you then make people believe you care about them? So the art of manifesting energies that you are the opposite of is itself what most people put most of their energy in. So hence you have people who are fundamentally corrupt, evil, but cannot ever get elected, win, or have anything go their way if that manifests. So they hide that, manifest its opposite, and then go through plausible deniability when they are caught, and have others around them who will deny on their behalf, forgive them on their behalf, apologize on their behalf. And we see this all the time in everything. And it is only when you step aside from the ism that you're a part of, Catholicism, Judaism, capitalism, communism, Marxism, whatever it is, and simply say, what is the truth of this moment? And then focus your energy on that truth. And if the truth is, if I want a sustainable world, I, Gary Noll, have to make myself sustainable. And how do I do that? What do I need for health and happiness? And then focus upon that, then look, are others doing the same? And hence I challenged Al Gore. Please, Al, get rid of the private jets, become a vegan, become really conscious, instead of making a gigantic hundreds of millions of dollar empire, owning current television, everything else, from being the new God figure in the environmental movement. Because the real environmentalist, who didn't have the public appeal and didn't win the Nobel Prize, etc., those are the people who are forgotten. And suddenly all the work of the people who have done a good job and who have lived it, who have walked it and talked it, never again are they paid attention to, because they're not the hip person on the block. And so unfortunately, we as a society, even in the environmental movement, cannot recognize it. And I would assume that you share some of those points of view. Final quick thought, Derek.
Well, I think that there's so much that you said that's really good there. And then I would also just add that one of the important things is there's also institutional power, that I think that the important thing is not that we necessarily navigate systems of oppressive power with as much integrity as possible. I think that that's one important thing, but I think it's really, really important that we dismantle those systems of oppressive power. And so I guess that's where I'd end with this.
I would absolutely agree, and that's what those of us who are not attached to the system and therefore can see it for its strengths and weaknesses will be trying to do. Derek, thank you very much. I look forward to an extended conversation in the near future. I'll have you back on our Progressive Commentary Hour, where we have one full hour or longer if we need be to discuss this in depth.
That sounds great.
Derek's new book is Dreams. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment with our issues. Please stay with us.
When Jesus wore, he washed my sins away.
Oh, happy day.
happy day.
Oh, happy day.
Oh, a happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus walked.
When Jesus walked.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. Going into the final segment of our program, now that all of our guests will be in the middle of the show instead of the end, you won't have a problem listening to all of them. We won't get to everything I hope to get to today, but we will have a chance to share a few points here with you. However, for those of you who've been coming to the world premiere of Knocking on the Devil's Door, which is not just a film, it is the beginning of a major new movement. It is to help all those, honor all those individuals from all those groups who have been fighting against the nuclear proliferation. And this is a new tool. It's a major documentary. Tonight is the last night. At 4 o'clock and 8 o'clock, just show up. There's always some seats available. I'm going to be there for both showings. I suggest you come early because the president's going to be in town in the lower area. So make sure you get there early so you don't have a problem with parking. And then the big push comes, but I won't go into that now. And joining me in studio is Jason and Elizabeth. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Gary. How are you?
Good.
Good. I was just actually going on Facebook and going over some of the stuff, and I just wanted to point out that our Facebook is actually a place where people come and talk and discuss stuff, and we have stuff that points of action, our nuclear stuff, our AIDS stuff, our vaccine, our fracking stuff. On our site, we don't just want people talking about their boyfriends or little common stuff.
I won't allow that.
Right. So
there are plenty of sites. If you want to tell us what you had for breakfast, plenty of sites to do that.
Yes, again.
This is a progressive Facebook. I don't have a chance to read it. I don't go there.
I'm sorry I don't
because I can't. My schedule doesn't provide that. But I have provided it a form for telling people what are the important articles, documentaries, video clips, points of action, calls to action, pieces of legislation, where we're at on these, important authors who I believe whose work should be paid attention to. That's what it's about. It's about empowering.
And we appreciate everyone coming, but please, we want to empower people. We want to keep putting new stuff up for you, videos, news articles, everything. So please, if you can just keep it to new stuff that could be worthwhile for someone, please do.
Not just that. It's a place for empowerment. Positive ideals, positive energy is what is needed. There's plenty of places for anger, negativity, toxic thoughts. This isn't the place.
Agreed.
Okay?
Yeah,
because I want a place that actually empowers people. By the way, for those of you who didn't have a chance to get there, here are some comments from people who were just there to watch. This is just as they walked out the door. Listen.
It's an amazing movie, thought-provoking.
Awesome.
This is very important.
Very empowering, which is absolutely necessary and terrifying.
Fantastic.
An eye-opener.
Unbelievable.
It was remarkable.
Just amazing.
Wow.
It's chilling.
Powerful.
Educational.
Awakening.
You gotta see this.
Excellent.
Fantastic.
Very informative. It's incredible.
This film is great.
Real eye-opener. Scientific.
Really touched me.
Illuminating.
Excellent movie.
Inspiring.
And a lot of energy.
Earth-shattering. It's absolutely extraordinary.
It's impeccable.
Distressing.
Fantastic.
Amazing.
So those are a few thoughts from people who were there. I want to thank all the people who both supported this non-commercial station and who are now ready for the next step. I'll be giving you the information for our next step, which will be a worldwide effort. Worldwide. I'm expecting upwards of 5 million people to be joining us on this effort on September 21st. More on that on an upcoming program. I want to say goodbye to our audience listening on our land-based stations, but continue listening as we go to Elizabeth and some commentary for the final 6 minutes of our program on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Gary. I wonder if you'd like to go over London again with us, because we've had on the news there's been more from Bill O'Reilly and in the UK as well. The big issues for them are it's about criminality. It's about getting law and order, having stronger laws, larger prison sentences. It's nothing to do with protests. And they're talking about how they're blacks, Muslims, minority groups. They've been brought from a bad country that they're in. They're coming into another country, and all they want to do is bring their violent ways and background to create social unrest and undermine the civil order in this country. What are your thoughts on this, please?
I believe that we should not give reactive answers. That's all I'm hearing. I believe we should step back and look at this as if it's a thousand pieces of a puzzle. At this moment, there are only certain pieces we can put up in front of us and examine. But even which piece you pick up and how you see that will be based upon your own conditioning. We know right now that about 85 to 90% of everything that we're exposed to each day, we will either accept or reject based upon our preconditioned mindset. So if it doesn't match what you're used to, conditioned to believe in, then you automatically must reject it, no matter if it has benefit, truth or not. Let's just use a few examples in the time we have. First, on the violence. I believe that almost everyone should abhor violence. It is non-constructive. The burning of buildings, the throwing of stones, this is not the way to get change. It is the way of getting attention. It certainly is a way of relieving stress, but at whose cost? So I think it should be, the violence should be universally condemned. It is wrong. Also, a second piece of this, how many people are participating? It's into the thousands. How many young people live in ghetto areas of London and of the rest of England? Several million. How many other people not living in ghetto areas are teenagers or in the same age group? Over 8 million. So when you look at the total number of people who are young and frustrated, but who are not using these techniques to express that anger and rage, it is under 1%. Therefore, do not condemn all youth. Do not condemn all poor people. Do not condemn the parents of poor people or the teenagers themselves, because you are not witnessing all those who are not participating. That would be the same in the United States. For those who are participating, then what is another piece of the puzzle? What are the underlying conditions? First, there are gangs. At any given moment, you know there are gangs. There are gangs that hide out in the park, and when you ride a bike by, come and knock you down, kick in the teeth, take your bike and ride off. These are people who have criminal intent. These are people who are simply angry, manifesting only antisocial behavior. It doesn't matter who you are. You could be poor. You could be in a wheelchair. If they think they can sell your wheelchair, they're going to take it. Those are people that we have in every society, but they are a very tiny minority. But we pay attention to what someone does that is so extreme in violence. But then we should not paint everyone with that same brush. Then what about those youth who are unemployed, who have demonstrated peacefully? And when they demonstrated peacefully, no one paid attention. The media chose not to find a story because it didn't bleed. And if it didn't bleed, it doesn't lead. And so all the people who are willing at the legislative level, the chairman of the Exchequer, that's their Secretary of Treasury, and the Prime Minister, they chose to give the banks upwards of 20% of the country's social structure, safety net financing to the banks, the very banks that misled people, the very banks that don't need the money, and in turn took it away from pensioners, from other social services that make even the poor, and middle class poor, that hurts everyone who is not affluent. Did they ever think that there might be a cause and effect? Did they ever think that maybe instead of giving the banks this money, that they put this into better education, into counseling, to have better systems within poor neighborhoods to help people get on their feet? You give people a job that pays a living wage, and you treat them with respect, and watch how few come out to protest. Now, let's say that you're a young person, and there's a 700% profiling of young black people in England versus a white person in England. The mere fact that you're black, you're being profiled. There's over 388 cases of young blacks and others being killed in police custody in the last several years. Not one cop was ever brought to justice. Not one. So therefore, their anger against the police, at least those who live in the environment, who've been profiled, they have a justified right to be angry. They do not have a right to commit violence. Violence, begetting violence, is not a solution. But this also means that maybe those who are more reasoned will look at changing the underlying social structure to see if they can't implement jobs and a better quality of life for those who are at the very bottom and most likely to rebel. Then you have youth, and what percentage of those youth have not had the education or the moral background, the ethical background from their parents and others to say their ways of protesting are poverty and are discrimination against us in a peaceful way. And then you should ask, if your father was Martin Luther King, what would he suggest? How would you protest? If your father was Gandhi, how would he suggest? Do you think they wouldn't protest? Yes, they would protest. Would they take their grievances any place they could be heard to change them? Yes, they would. Would they defy authority? Yes, they would. But they wouldn't be burning people's shops and homes. They wouldn't be taking people and beating them up. They wouldn't be breaking into companies to get their iPhones and iPods and all this. They would be taking their message, articulate it as they could, with spokespersons and union organizations. They would be taking it to the power, seat of power, and they'd be protesting and hanging out. They would be using more of a model that was done in Egypt, and therefore have a greater likelihood of having someone at some point say, yes, we must address this, otherwise there will be uncontrolled violence. Those are only a few pieces of the puzzle. I'll address more on an upcoming show, but we're out of time.
Thank you. I hope you become Prime Minister of our country, England, at some point. That'll be very good.
You don't have Prime Ministers in England. You have a bunch of corporatists who sell out quickly. We've seen that. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all very much for listening.
I need your love in a heavenly hour. I need your love in a heavenly
hour.
I need your love in a heavenly hour. I need your love in a heavenly hour. I need your love in a heavenly hour. I need your love in a heavenly
hour. Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tabenfeld.